what makes the human being need to be in relationships, and how can one affect these relationships to allow growth? I'm encompassing something which is moving from the sciences to relationships.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Hi, welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Yehuda Frankel. Dr. Frankel is a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst and a member of the Israeli Psychoanalytic Society. As you will hear in today's interview, Dr. Frankel has spent most of his professional career working at the interface of medical care, psychiatry, and psychoanalysis. He has devoted himself to teaching medical students, teaching residents, and also working for many, many years with family physicians. He has run a Balint group for family physicians since 1995. He has run courses in psychotherapy, and he consults with a large group of family physicians since 1993. We have also had the opportunity to work together in the IPA and Health Committee, which has been a pleasure for me. With great pleasure, here is my interview with Dr. Yehuda Frankel. Yehuda, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on board. You and I have worked together for a while now on the IPA and Health Committee, and that's how I've learned of your long-standing interest in the mind-body interface. It seems to me that different individuals would understand this mind-body space differently. A psychoanalyst who works mostly with the mind would approach it one way. A family physician who works mostly with the body would understand it another way. And non-clinicians would just be trying to make one's way in the world and be struggling, as we all do, with various aches and pains. Sometimes they're hard to understand. My understanding of the mind-body interface is specifically through what I understand to be somatization. Now, we're going to talk about these various words because I know you have your own thoughts and experiences with them. But my understanding of somatization is when someone has an affect, a feeling that for any one of a number of reasons, they're not able to register as an affect or a feeling. And instead, their body sort of speaks for them. And we all have commonplace examples of this when one has a headache. Oftentimes, if you have an opportunity to sit with that, you'll discover that there's a feeling that underlies the headache. It could be sorrow, it could be anger, it could be something that the body is transforming into a physical experience. There are other commonplace examples. We know there's this entity called white coat hypertension, where you can go to the doctor's office and not feel necessarily anxious, but your blood pressure is way higher than it used to be. That's the body representing anxiety that you're not consciously aware of. And there are much more malignant versions of it. There is what's called somatic memories, which was written about starting, I believe, in the 1990s, though Freud also reflected on it. It reminds me of a situation I had many years ago where a young woman all of a sudden started feeling burning sensations on her abdomen. And it was only later that she came to recall that she, in fact, was intentionally burned with an iron by a family member for her refusing his sexual advances. And she didn't remember that until her body reminded her of that. That's the somatic memories that our bodies carry. And there are also far less intense and troublesome scenarios. Families have styles, and there are some families that have styles of communicating with each other through aches and pains. That's the vehicle for intimacy. It reminds me of the old joke, you ask the child of a physician what they want to be when they grow up, and they answer, a patient. That is that to be a patient is to be recognized and appreciated and attended to. And so they can develop this family language of physical attention and intimacy. You've been involved in this field for a long time. You've taught medical students, residents, family physicians, and I know you have thoughts about the various words that are used in the mind-body interface space. Can you walk us through how you understand it and what your work currently involves?
Well, thank you very much, Harvey, for letting me in on this psychoanalysis and health in the IPA. And it's very exciting to be working with you for that. For the last year, actually, with the whole group, rethinking health and psychoanalysis. Now, I want to relate to some of these very important concepts that you put us, that you put on board together tonight with me. And these are all thoughts that were not allowed to be in medicine, that were very strange to the medical processes in the 19th and 18th century, that feelings, thoughts, memories can affect the way we react, the way we feel, the way our heart or lungs operate or do not operate. It was very prevalent to look in literature or look in the culture and see that there is this connection. But in medicine, it was kind of disavowed, and later developed the whole concept of somatization or psychosomatics, where actually, if we talk about modern concepts, mentalization is, I think, one to consider, where the body speaks out, as you said rightly, speaks out affects, feelings, anxieties, or even subconscious conflicts which cannot be felt or spoken. So certainly, with this notion, we know a lot. We know that pain, we know that pain syndromes like lower back pain, like PMS, like fibromyalgia, all have to do somewhat, more or less, with emotions, with relationships. But to my understanding, this is walking a great mile. We need another one. And that is what's called in the book that sometimes people still look at, the DSM, psychological factors affecting medical disorder. So, somatization or psychosomatics deals with panic, okay, or deals with IBS. But what about heart attacks? What about cancer? What about a plateau of different medical issues which can be seen in the lab, which we have pathology for, which we even have medical treatment for? Are they not relevant to the person looking for emotions? Are they not relevant for the patient to speak about and get help for? I think the answer is yes. And this is truly my interest from being a medical student and being a resident, trying to reach these patients who actually do suffer from a disease that can be seen in a microscope, does have histology, does have pathology. These patients still need help in order to cope, in order to be able to deal with their disease in a much better way. Let's just take one example. The famous papers from the 1990s about survival post-MI after the first week, 6 months post-MI post am I? What is the prediction factor which is strongest to survival? It's not how big the MI is. It's not even the heart failure. It was found in many studies that the most important factor in predicting staying alive after 6 months is depression in the day of being discharged from hospital. And this is the area which has and is still very interesting to me, working together with family physicians and doctors.
You know, I had seen that study, and I was interested because there are also studies that talk about the support system that people have when they're discharged from the hospital, both a caring caretaker and also a community support system. And I don't believe that last study that you mentioned about depression directly links the two, but it certainly leads one to wonder about whether the depression is also related to the absence or presence of a caring, attentive support system.
I think it could go both ways for sure. You know, what's really interesting is when this fact is dealt with in psychiatric papers, there's a tendency to talk about depression and possible MIs connected with the serotonin levels in platelets.
Right.
But when you ask a family physician, you ask him, well, how does depression relate to death in the context of cardiac disease? He laughs and says, listen, dear brother, the patient needs to stop smoking, start doing sports, change his diet, and have a new lifestyle. Depression is the last thing that would allow that. So he's going to die because he can't do what I want him to do. As simple as that.
And it also touches on the subject of the broken heart syndrome, which is also well studied, where people who suffer a terrible loss, loss of a spouse, for example, will often have cardiac problems or lethal MIs within the next year afterwards. So there clearly is this interface between affects and physical expression, like you're describing.
Yes. Yes. So I recall a patient that I had, I would say 25 years ago, in a clinic that was designed for cardiac patients, where me and a fellow psychologist were sitting. So the first one came in and said, I'm very angry at my family physician. I asked him, can you tell me why? He said, he thinks I'm depressed. I'm not depressed. Well, clearly the patient was anxious, sleepless, agitated.
Yeah.
And after some bargaining, we decided he suffers from anxiety. And I treated him with an SSRI. I only had 3 sessions to see him. But he came later after a few months and he told me, listen, doctor, I'm not a stupid fellow. I knew I have depression. But how would it be for you to get the diagnosis of an MI and a depression in the same week? That was too much.
Meaning he was doing it to try to take care of you? Is that what you're saying?
No. He had to deny his depression in order to keep his self-image. He couldn't take two diagnoses in the same time.
He couldn't take, got
and
it.
Denying the depression was lethal. Now, the next patient coming in on that same day was also a post-MI patient, but he also had coronary artery bypass graft within 24 hours of the infarct. He came in hypomanic. He was driving his vehicle. He walked a mile and a half to the clinic. And it was really frightening to see the hypomanic patient.
Sure.
So when we were speaking, he told me, listen, I came in with a myocardial infarct. They tried to treat me. But because I have good relationships in the hospital, my wife knows a nurse in another ward, I was a star patient. Therefore, they actually put me in surgery that same night and changed 3 of my vessels. Well, it doesn't take much to understand that the poor patient once almost died with an MI. And then when he was in the cath room, they severely damaged his LAD, and therefore he had to go emergency surgery. He was almost dying twice in the same night. The only way to deal with it was to develop a severe manic defense, which was, again, very dangerous for him. So two patients, same disease, one depressed, one hypomanic, and the doctors ask us to help them treat these patients vis-a-vis the cardiac treatment.
Now, you consult with family physicians on a regular basis now. Do I have that correct?
Yes.
And could you share with us the kinds of situations that they ask for your insights about?
I'll start from the beginning. What I've been doing in the last, I would say, 25 years is there is a diploma course in the family physician specialization, which they study many different parts of medicine, and I teach psychiatry and psychology. So I meet the new physicians every year for 4 to 5 meetings. We talk a little about medications. Then we talk about what does it mean to be a patient? What does it mean to be a doctor? Defense mechanisms. Accepting, not accepting, being frightened, being angry. And when we finish the mini course, I tell them, no, we didn't finish anything. That was an introduction. People who want to learn, please keep consulting with me. They call me for anything. First, they call me for psychopharmacology, but for me, success is when they don't need me anymore. They can do it alone. They call me how to deal with patients, how to deal with families, how to introduce the bad news, how to deal with the personality disorders who do not take care of themselves, how to deal with the doctor's inability or futility or feelings of aggression. And this is ongoing work for more than 20 years.
You know, you mentioned asking for your help in how to deliver bad news. It reminds me when I was a medical student in the 70s, we had a class scheduled with a urologist, and the title of the class was Fluid Balance. And so we walk into the room, and the urologist, I remember it like it was yesterday, he said, you know, You folks here can go learn this on your own. You have the textbook. Fluid balance is a fairly easy, straightforward thing for you to learn. Let's talk about something really difficult. Let's talk about how you tell someone they have metastatic cancer. And this urologist had us role play telling a patient new information that they're basically going to die from their illness. This was in the 70s. And I never forgot that. The next physician who walked into the room saw the writings on the blackboard, and he said, you know, that's easy stuff telling people about it. Let's talk about surgery. Not to be critical of the surgeons, but it's just that, you know, different people have different strengths, and certain people can offer students one thing. And you obviously can offer students and residents and physicians a great deal of understanding. Can you give us case examples that you've helped?
You really reminded me now of a case with a urologist. Very interesting. You know, there's a new syndrome in our days, which is called pelvic pain syndrome or chronic prostatitis.
Sure.
And medicine has been struggling with that. So I had a patient who underwent 2 surgical interventions for that. And then he came to me. And I was really trying to stop the third intervention. Now, the patient was clearly a very avoidant personality, restricted, could function much less than actually what was inside him, and he wasn't having any sexual relationships for 3 years. So then I decided to call the chief of urology in the hospital he was in and to discuss it with him. So the person was over 70, knows me as a student. He said, what are you talking about, Yehuda? This person has what was called once in psychiatry conversion. There's nothing wrong in his prostata. He's suffering because he doesn't have any sexual relationships. I promise you, I will not do any surgery on him. So that was one urology intervention.
Right, right. Sometimes they knew things that other doctors didn't know, right?
One thing that I think really is helpful for the doctors is to lead the way of taking care of the patient vis-a-vis the classical defense mechanism. For instance, it's very hard to teach splitting in psychology. Are you Kleinian? Are you not Kleinian? Bad breast, good breast. But when you have a group of doctors who are practicing and tell them, you know, you're either going to be the best doctor in the world or the worst doctor in the world, and it can interchange within 24 hours, they all start laughing and crying. And they said, this really gives so much sense to our work. We're going to use it.
Yeah.
And people come years later and say, this was the most important teaching vignette we had. Because every time they make us into a god, we know in 2 days, nothing's going to be left. But still better, when they declare, we did nothing, we don't care, we're stupid, we don't have any empathy. With all the guilt that's being put on us, we still remember it's transference. It's not only what we do, but it's something the patient needs to do. And this is a really good Ventolin for us.
That's a real gift for a physician to be able to realize that it isn't always about them. It's also about the way the patient's minds work in relation to them.
Mm-hmm. And then when you try to share with them passive aggressive, when they bring their examples from their office, then afterwards it feels different for them.
Yeah.
They know it's not personal. They know that when the patient says, can I see where you really studied and how far you were in your class and what is your scientific research doing today? They know there's nothing personal there. And they can sit on their chair and take care of the patient without feeling totally crumbled like we all used to be.
Sure, sure. And do you continue this kind of contact with them in balance groups?
Yes, I have had on and off a few balance groups in Jerusalem. And it's a very useful tool in order for doctors to share and reflect their feelings.
Can you share with us about what balance groups are? That we had an interview with the balance groups here in the States in Boston, but for people who are not familiar with it, can you just give a brief summary of what a balance group is?
Yeah. Well, Michael Balint and his wife put up this concept of balance groups where doctors sit and talk about everything but medicine, about their feelings, about their frustrations, about where they failed, about where they transgressed, about where anger predominant their behavior, about boundaries between home and work, anger at the systems, inability to finish a day's work, feelings in the office. And doctors find out that there's a lot more mutuality than they believe. They are not alone in this. And sharing the feelings can certainly allow dealing with them in a much better way, in a much more integrated way, and with much less guilt and much less feelings of it's only because of me. So people come in and talk about hating a patient and missing some diagnosis or some workup because the patient does not allow them to come close to them. People can come in and talk about what it means to be endangered by a patient, by patient's violence, physical, verbal, and what does it do to their work? How can one find out about it before it really happens? How does one set boundaries to patients? For instance, the patient who comes in every 2 days or every week and needs 30 minutes and takes up the time of three other patients, for instance, to tell him, well, Mr. John, we have 10 minutes today and pick the most painful thing you have and let's talk about it for the whole 10 minutes, which sometimes does a lot of work for the patient and for the doctor.
And they're doing this among colleagues. They're talking with you among colleagues who understand it.
Yes. Usually it's 2 liters.
Usually what? Oh, two liters, yeah. Uh-huh.
two leaders, ideally one physician and one mental health specialist, with a group of doctors. Here we have mostly family physicians, but in other parts of the world, it could be any specialty.
Uh-huh.
I've heard that Balint has been used for lawyers recently, too. They deal with the same problem.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
How interesting. I've not heard that. Wow. And that's something you've heard of happening in Israel? Because I've not heard it in the States.
In Israel.
In Israel, uh-huh.
So, for instance, in a group, one female doctor talks about a patient taking off his shirt, and she suddenly feels a very beautiful patient, and she gets aroused and very intimidated by her arousal. Am I not doing my work? Should I be moving out of here? Have I failed the patient? But then if two or three other doctors say, well, it has happened to us, it's something that happens, then it's already something one can digest, one can deal with, one can know you're not a terrible doctor because something turns you on. You're a terrible doctor if you go with it. But the feeling of closeness or intimacy or arousal are part of the human existence also in the doctor's office, as much as we do that in psychoanalysis, and we are aware of it. Actually, I think, and this is one point which is always very interesting, we say transference is in the consultation room within a therapist-patient relationship. I would argue that transference is much stronger when the doctor puts his hands on you, the family physician or surgeon or cardiologist, because then the doctor is truly bringing out the mother, which was in the picture in early ages. And therefore, there must be a whole lot of transference in the doctor, physical doctor-patient relationship.
That's a very valuable message, especially that you brought the example of the woman physician who's uncomfortable with her arousal with a male patient, because we so often hear about it with male physicians being aroused by female patients. And of course, it happens with all combinations, and it is difficult for people to speak about. And I could imagine such a group would offer great relief. And consolation for someone who's feeling very guilty about it.
Yes.
We all end up in aspects of medicine and even in psychiatry and psychoanalysis for various reasons. You've chosen a very particular area, the mind-body interface, though I know you do regular psychoanalytic work as well. Can you share with us a bit about you and your background and what has brought you to this work and what the particular satisfactions you feel are about it?
Well, for me, medicine is really an art that is sitting on so many different origins of knowledge, of human thinking, sciences, social sciences, and human relationships. More so, the gift to be both a doctor and a therapist is really encompassing so many different parts of our culture, of human culture. When I taught in psychology, I would challenge them, where do you really think a psychology should be? So, you know, nowadays many people who train for psychology say, well, it's the sciences. It's all about receptors.
Sure.
Yeah, that's the sad answer we get today. Some people would say social sciences, and I would argue, no, it's humanistics. Relationship between people, trying to understand people, is part of humanistics. My background is actually, I come from a very scientific family. Grandfather, father, who were scientists, math, physics. But from early age, I was very much enthusiastic to learn and practice what it is to be close to in relationships. What makes the human being need to be in relationships, and how can one affect these relationships to allow growth? So in hindsight, I think that I'm encompassing something which is moving from the sciences to relationships, which is moving from what can be in a way looked at from outside to be really felt in the dyad, and to be really changed with not by manipulating or changing the environment, but rather by two people taking care together of one person within a relationship. And always knowing that there's a lot of unknown there, that nothing could be exact, nothing could even be reproducible in a way. Every time it's a new place, it's a new set of the mind.
It's beautifully said. And do you find your work well received by the general medical community?
Well, I'm biased because the ones I work with certainly receive it well. The ones who don't receive it won't work with me. I find that family physicians are very receptive to this work because they are challenged by being in a relationship which is ongoing with a patient. But I think I can learn with them from them a lot because they have this ongoing relationship with a patient and with his family, or sometimes many generations for years and years. So they even have something that we don't have, an ability to look at generations or siblings or mothers and infants and know more than the consulting a doctor can get in one or two or three sessions. There's a lot to learn from them and share with them. So it's mutually very gratifying.
And they also have, like you say, the experience of touch.
Yes.
Which adds a power and an intimacy to the relationship. And also, as we know, challenges as well.
Yes, definitely. And then when sometimes I have these consultations or changing of ideas with surgeons or cardiologists, and I see how much they are emotionally in touch with the patient. I had this patient who was with a severe mitral valve regurgitation and stenosis, very high blood pressure. And the only medication that could work for him stimulates the hypertension. Mm-hmm. So chief of thoracic surgery, I was calling in telling him, you know, to give him this medication is to really risk the stenosis. He told me, Dr. Frankel, you take care of the depression. I'll take care of the hypertension because he's going to die from the depression.
Mm. And he understood that.
Yeah. And one can really find that. One can really find that. And then they work together.
Yeah. Lovely.
Cardiologists are now giving, are sending to consultation, are giving SSRIs. They know that we are talking about emotions and the heart. Actually, the heart is considered in culture the seat of emotions, literature.
Right. We're going back to the poetic notion of the heart.
Yes.
The heart is, like you say, the seat of emotions, not just the mechanical heart.
Yeah.
Well, on a talk on the mind-body interface, that's a very apropos point for us to pause about the mind, the body, and the heart as physical muscle and the heart as the seat of our emotions. And your experience and your work appreciating both fields really comes across in your descriptions. I want to thank you for talking with us, for sharing your experience with us. There'll be notes associated with this podcast and some readings if people want to take their readings further. But I want to thank you for spending time with us, Yehuda. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Harvey, and it's really joy and love of learning to work with you. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.